From KCRW, I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food. The life of LA chef Roy Choi seems ready-made for TV. Many of you already know him as the founder of Kogi, the man who helped pioneer the food truck movement here in LA, who now owns a mini empire of restaurants. But in recent years, he's been pursuing a higher calling.
Us in life, we're able to maybe fulfill a lot of things going on in our head, but we can't get to all of them. So this show allowed me to some of the things that I couldn't take all the way to the finish line, see others that did. And it just helps me to continue to be inspired and learn.
Roy has a brand new television show called Broken Bread. It premiered this week on KCET. Although he's the host of the show, he isn't the main focus. Instead, the 6 episodes spotlight remarkable leaders who are using food to transform their communities. Hi.
Hey.
It's so interesting to see you in this space and put your passion and your ethos.
Tell me about it.
You've waited a long time.
It took me a long time to figure out what I wanted to say on TV, you know. And I was okay if that road never was crossed too, you know. Like, I mean, you've known me a long time, Evan. I know I have this like public persona, but I'm a really private dude, you know. And I like being behind the scenes. I like riding the bus alone and riding metro alone and soaking up all the things that life has. And, you know, I like cooking behind buildings and under street lamps. No one knows I'm there except the people that were there, you know. And that's, so I'm fine without TV, but it just kept knocking on my door. You know, it was one of those things, you know.
But the thing about the series that I really like is you really put the spotlight on the folks who you feature in each episode.
Yeah. The good thing about taking a while on something is you develop more control and more peace within yourself, and you know exactly what you're willing to do and what you want to do. And so you don't really have to succumb to the pressures of a studio or, you know, the production company or whatever. It's like, it's kind of like take it or leave it. You know what I mean? Like, I'm in that position now. So in the take it or leave it position, I'm able to move the lens of the story away from this maybe ego-driven thing about myself or the self-glorification and really make it a show about the things I'm interested in. And I wanted to use the show also as a way for me to continue to learn. I don't know everything. I've given a lot, but I run out of knowledge sometimes, you know. You can only do so much. So there are other people out there doing so many things that I don't get to interact with every day. So this was an opportunity to go out and really learn from them.
Yeah, I always look at new projects as kind of like a college assignment.
Yeah,
where
exactly.
You get to research and study and learn a whole new focus.
And especially with the partners that I had with KCET, Public Television, and TasteMade, a global media company that cares about the little things, you know, it's like there was no pressure to do something that was inauthentic just for ratings. You know, it was truly a college project. It was like sitting down in a study group together. It would be like if you and I created a TV show, you know. it's truly like we sit down, it's a study group, and we're like, how do we get to the core of what we're trying to say? A big part of it, too, was it's packed with information, and it is like this assignment, the study assignment, but I always had to remember that it had to be entertainment, too.
Oh, it's totally,
you know,
it's really engaging. I mean, the people pull you in.
Mm-hmm.
Let's talk a minute, go back, and share a bit about how food saved you and how you found stories that some of them are very like-minded, in particular the very first one with Father Greg Boyle.
So the titles of our shows are one word. The opening episode is called Transformation. And what we tried to do was, you know, it's hard in our normal life to talk about the ups and downs of life, you know, because no one wants to hear the downs, you know, and no one wants to admit to the broken systems and the problems and the people that get pushed out to the peripheral and to the margins.
And even I think these days in particular, if you're interested in that, it gets overwhelming. You have no idea where to start.
So sometimes you just have to start with one foot in front of the other. You have to start with the closest thing to you. You have to start with the closest person to you. You have to start with the low-hanging fruit. You have to start with just a simple, small thing, a hello, a hug. Even though sometimes we don't know where to start or it's something that we don't want to talk about in our normal life, the stuff is real. You know, it's out there. There are folks that are pushed out of the system, that are addicted to drugs, that try to come back into kind of the hamster wheel of society. They don't know how to fit back in, you know. And so transformation is really looking at three organizations. One is Homeboy Industries, obviously run by Father Greg Boyle. We have a pizza shop out in the valley called Dough Girl.
Unbelievable story, right?
Yeah.
Unbelievable
run by
story.
Mar Diego and a bunch of kids out there in the valley and in Van Nuys and Lake Balboa and Pacoima and, you know, that are homeless and that are just need a helping hand, you know. And then I also talked to the mayor, Eric Garcetti, about these problems, you know, just asking, can there be some sort of, I don't even want to call it a socialist system, but some sort of pay it forward system that allows us to figure out how do we fix this in some way, not overnight, but, how, you know, it can't continue because it seems like it keeps getting bigger and bigger. You know, homelessness, drug addiction, reentry programs, imprisonment, false imprisonment, making a mistake at 18 years old and never having a chance to be seen as a full human again, you know, so.
How do programs like Homeboy and Dough Girl help to lower the rate of recidivism?
Well, what, I know that's such a hard one. I'm glad you said it and I didn't say it. we would have been here all day. I don't know. I'm sure KCET or if we if we reach out to Homeboy, we can get the exact numbers. But I do know that the program is extremely successful.
Really successful.
And to everyone, not only to the directors that we talk to and the program leaders, but also the actual people, the students as well, and to Father Greg Boyle as well.
What really impressed me in that episode was how Broken Bread was able to reveal the power of just being present.
Yeah.
Being present for
being
people.
Present. You know, when I was interviewing Father Greg, he says something that's been sticking with me ever since, and also because I had to go through and look at all the edits and everything. But he said, how do we know that the real world got it right? You know? And he says in the show, I have gangbangers that were shooting at each other and killing each other, making croissants together. Isn't that the world that we want? You know, how do we know that the world that we've created that creates these problems that we come from is the right world? It's really leading with love, giving people a chance to find themselves. Same with Mar, you know, not having things confined to a finite space of time. You know, sometimes things take a while. It doesn't happen like one step after another. Sometimes you have to allow it to develop and to mature.
Her persistence. Yeah. Her persistence.
Oh, Mar is the G.
I have to meet her.
You have to. Go up there, right? You know, she's there every day, but she's from the Pacoima Projects. She was running the dope game out here in L.A. back in the late 80s, 90s. You know, got caught up, went in, came out. She, you know, just kind of very, very similar story to myself where almost at kind of like the last end of the road, cooking came into her life because she got thrown into the kitchen during prison time. And it just, you know, like for me on the couch with Emerald, for her in prison, it just created the butterflies and everything felt like it came together finally. And then she staged with Wolfgang and eventually opened this pizza shop, which is, let me describe the pizza shop too. The pizza shop is a small little pizza shop in a mini mall in Lake Balboa. It's run by Mar and pretty much about 9 to 10 kids that come from the riverbed, LA riverbed. They grew up in the valley, but for some reason, whatever reason, at 13, 14, 15, 16, they became homeless and out on the streets. And she brings these kids in. And the high school is right next door, and they don't want it. They don't allow these kids to come back, but she brings these kids right in and just puts them to work. And the great thing is a lot of us that don't fit in or do get pushed out to the margins, when someone opens the door and you're allowed to, because a lot of us have learning disabilities or dyslexia or we can't, or some form of anxiety and we can't fit in. But if you put someone with dough and allow them to figure out and you have these very visceral sensory things that you put them through and you share love, it's amazing. They run the shop on their own.
Really incredible. Yeah. The show really takes a wide view over the course of the episodes. And in one of them, we hear about food deserts in lower income neighborhoods.
Yeah.
Where access, where access is practically non-existent. And Olympia Osset is looking to change that in South LA. Tell us what she's doing with Supermarket. She spells like you do.
Yeah. You take out letters. Yeah. It's SUPRMRKT, I believe.
Yeah.
Supermarket in the Crenshaw District in Leimert. And when I first started the show, we did our research. Obviously, I'm working with these great teams and these amazing research departments. We did a three-tier effect. We did that. I thought of people that I knew, and then I put it out because, you know, like I built my last 10 years on my relationship with everyone online. So I put it just out there. Yo, doing Broken Bread, please send us people that you think are inspiring that are changing the world. And Olympia came through one of those recommendations through Twitter. Man, she's doing great stuff. It's an organic produce delivery system that she also sets up on the weekend at Leimert Park in the farmer's market. But she also has this service where you go on and you pay these ridiculously low, amazing, kind of like should-be type prices for produce. So a mango that at a normal farmer's market, which might be $3, $4, is like 75 cents, you know. And but the reason why she can do that is she goes out of her way to find what's called kind of second batch, or she'll go directly to the organic farmers, distributors. And every week, about 15 to 20, probably more by now, people, they fill out their request, and then they get a box filled with whatever she finds that week in the farms. And then she goes out and physically delivers them to their house all throughout South Central Los Angeles.
That's really incredible.
Yeah, and she's extremely bright and just has this vision. And you know, when you meet people that are completely sure, spiritually sure of themselves and what they're doing and their vision, and even if they're not completely there yet, you can already see it. It's like when you see someone that has a star quality when they're young or something, you know, it's like that person's going to be a star, you know, and you already know it. And that's kind of how what I see in her, like somehow her philosophy and this program and what she's doing and the outlook and the reasons of why she's doing it could be a component to a huge thing that could shift, I think, the dynamics of how people who don't have access to produce can get it.
Another thing that we see a lot in the food festival world, for example, is all the food waste, which just makes things insane. I mean, people buy tickets for hundreds of dollars and then so much food goes to waste. Mm-hmm. You introduce us to a man, Bill Bracken, who is repurposing food.
Yeah, so we went out to Orange County to meet Bill Bracken, and he does it not only with the program called Chefs to End Hunger, but also he's like the old milkman that would go around and collect the empty bottles on the porch, right? But instead he's collecting food that is about to go to waste. So I want you guys that are listening to get the right understanding of what he's picking up. It's not like food that's from the trash or whatever the case may be. Not that that's wrong. We were going to do dumpster diving as well. It didn't make the cut. But it's, okay, let's say you stay at a hotel and they have the free breakfast buffet in the morning, right? As a company, they have to keep all that food out. Or you go to a banquet or a wedding and you have a full buffet.
And it needs to be replenished so it looks appetizing.
It always needs to be replenished. And that's a part of what creates the waste in our supermarkets, where we have to have pyramids and pyramids of fruits and vegetables that look perfect even at 11 p.m., you know. Instead of looking like something that's real in life that at 11 p.m. has been shopped at all day, you know, and there should only be two or three left, right? Why does it have to be 600 stacked into a pyramid at 11 p.m.? But it's the same thing with buffet food, right? So even for the last guest, it has to look as if it was the first guest. And so what does that do? Obviously, creates waste. So he goes around and knocks on these doors and says, hey, do you have any of your breakfast sausages, eggs, and all these things left? And so they give him in these aluminum containers all the food. Normally, that food would go in the trash. So he takes all of that food from hundreds of hotels around Orange County, and he takes that and he takes it into the kitchen and he repurposes that. So a great way, an example to repurpose something like that, let's say you have 100 pounds of chicken satay skewers that come in from a banquet that you picked up that got delivered. That banquet was last night, gets delivered 6 a.m. So it's still something that is extremely fresh and edible. He takes that, takes them off the skewers, chops it up, turns it into a chicken soup, right? And because there's rice left over, there's chicken satay, there's a bunch of vegetables, and then all he really has to do is add a little bit of just the kind of like flavorings like salt, pepper,
ingenuity.
So he doesn't have to pay for any food cost. All that food would have gone to the trash, but instead he's able to repurpose it, work off volunteer help, and then go out and feed the homeless in Santa Ana.
And so what's it
every
like?
Night.
What's it like for you to see a food truck being used as a delivery system for hunger?
It's amazing. In a way, I feel Kogi is close to that because we still charge $2 for our food, you know. But if I had it my way, I wouldn't charge anything for our food. You know, a lot of people call me naive, Evan, but I want to live in a world where there's no money, where things are free. I mean, animals don't got to go to the bank, you know, go to the ATM machine, you know what I'm saying? Like, I just wish that it's always been a dream of mine to see it. And that's what inspires me. Us in life, we're able to maybe fulfill a lot of things going on in our head or our ideologies, but we can't get to all of them. So this show allowed me to some of the things that I couldn't take all the way to the finish line, see others that did. And it just helps me to continue to, I don't know, be inspired and learn.
So let's talk for a minute about something that's a completely different point of view. And I have to say that I'm a bit skeptical of, so I loved this episode. And it was the episode in which you go and visit Beyond Meat in El Segundo.
Yeah, that was our future episode, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it was really fascinating.
Right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
You bit into it and you had joy on your face.
I did. You know, and it was joy understanding. Okay, so you have to understand the joy because the joy is also something that is multifaceted. It tasted great, but it was also a joy of seeing something that is in development, right? The plant-based meat phenomenon and business has obviously taken over our world.
It's here to stay.
It's here to
grow.
Stay, yeah. But it's still an infant. So when I bit into it and you saw my face, it was this kind of situation where, wow, this is delicious, but also like, where is this going to be in 10 years?
Yeah, the potential.
Where are we going? You know, it's like hearing something being rehearsed, right? Like, I saw the future when I bit into it.
And you went to a cafe.
Yeah, up on Northeast LA in Eagle Rock.
And that seems like something that is complete.
So we tried to show in that episode three perspectives of what the future of food could look like. Because right now, the present, we're living in a world where we eat cows, chickens and pigs, you know, and tuna and salmon. And we eat them in quantities that are unhealthy, that we weren't designed to eat. 32 ounces of steak, 6 slices of bacon, a double-decker pastrami sandwich. And that's just in one day. That's breakfast, lunch, and dinner, right? And our bodies.
Who is that person?
It's us.
It's not me.
It's not you. It's you.
It's not me. I get the picture.
So the idea was to see, okay, is there a future where there could be a plant-based future of eating? So we looked at Hank and Bean doing foraging. We looked at Beyond Meat doing the processing. And then we looked at a pop-up group called the Vegan Hooligans, which are doing it right now. They're kind of doing it. They reminded me a lot of Kogi in the early days, you know, kind of like
they did a
we're not
trap.
Asking for permission. You know, we're coming in and we're just doing this and we got it's like a punk band. We got our crowd. Don't worry about it. You know, so
they did a Crunchwrap Supreme.
Yeah.
That looked really good.
It was really good. You should go to the pop up once. I think you'd love it. It was delicious. So we tried to show the culture of plant based eating, the development of it, and then also the science and the chef side of it. So for the Vegan Hooligans, Northeast LA, Highland Park, Eagle Rock, Block Party, Tuesdays, all that stuff is a whole thing, you know?
I love that the whole first season, hopefully there will be a second season, is all LA. Do you view the whole show as using LA as sort of a way of looking at the rest of the world? Because it's sort of like we represent everything.
Well, I think definitely the first season, it was a perfect fit for that. And it allowed me to stay local and really focus and do the show right. We learned a lot from the show from when we first started a year ago to now, you know. And I think we had a bunch of different ideas. What could it be? It's this, that, it's this. We'll go all over the world, find these problems. But now I realize that we have kind of our template. You know, it's these ideas, these one-word ideas, transformation, access, future, cannabis, waste, you know, and then we take these things. I feel like the next season could be like Bay Area, you know. The actual topics could change slightly, but it's the same template. Then from Bay Area, I can go to like South Chicago, and then even around the world, and really looking again at these broken systems. Why are we living in a world where we're constantly pushing people out to the margins and food is not accessible?
Yeah, we're living
and
in
we're wasting.
We're living in a world where the problems are pervasive mm-hmm. and the solutions are being looked at like one individual at a time.
Yes.
It's crazy.
Yeah.
Thank you so much, mm-hmm. Roy.
Thank you.
That's Roy Choi. We've been talking about his first TV series, Broken Bread, from KCET and Taste Made. In a moment, I'm talking with one of the remarkable people featured in Broken Bread, my conversation with Bill Bracken of Bracken's Kitchen after this short break. We're back on KCRW's Good Food. I'm Evan Kleiman. Roy Choi's new KCET show, Broken Bread, highlights the women and men who are transforming their communities through food. One person who caught my attention was Orange County chef Bill Bracken.
So we just set out to cater to people and provide them not only a meal, but just a great environment to feed them in and really help them escape some of life's hard realities for an hour or so and really help them just have a good time and, you know, not only feed their bellies, but feed their souls too and their spirits.
Bill started a food truck called Bracken's Kitchen in 2013 with the express purpose of serving the hungry. And I wanted to hear more about his journey. Welcome to Good Food.
Thank you so much. Honored to be here.
Oh, watching that episode, I was just like, wow. It's just so interesting to learn how this mission of taking care of people through food plays out in so many different ways, depending upon the personality of the person.
Indeed.
You founded Bracken's Kitchen in 2013.
Mm-hmm.
You're committed to serving 300,000 meals in 2019.
We've upped that ante a little bit. About 2 weeks ago, we're shooting for 400,000. Our official written goal is 350,000, but I'm shooting for 400,000, so.
Incredible. And as a person who spent so much of my culinary life before restaurants catering, I love that you use this phrase, catering with a cause.
Mm-hmm.
What does that mean for you?
Well, catering for a cause or with a cause is actually an income stream for us. But since you bring up catering, one of the things I like to describe and say about Bracken's Kitchen all the time is we're not a nonprofit. Of course, we are, but our mindset isn't that of a nonprofit. We like to say we're a catering company. We just happen to cater to those who can't afford to pay for their meal. So we just set out to cater to people and provide them not only a meal, but just a great environment to feed them in and really help them escape some of life's hard realities for an hour or so and really help them just have a good time and, you know, not only feed their bellies, but feed their souls too and their spirits.
So let's start at the beginning for you.
Oh, boy.
You come from a small town in Kansas.
You really are going to the beginning, aren't you? Yeah, about as big as this neighborhood we're in here in Santa Monica.
Yeah. So how did you end up in Southern California?
Fate, destiny, God, I don't know what you want to pick, but I actually graduated from the Culinary Institute of America and ended up in Texas after culinary school working with Four Seasons Hotels. And on a fateful day, Christmas Day, actually in 1986, we found out the hotel was sold. And 5 days later, we all were working for Marriott. And so all the leadership of Four Seasons left. One of my chefs opened the Four Seasons LA at Beverly Hills. Another one moved to Newport Beach. And a couple months later, they both called me. And, you know, I grew up listening to the Beach Boys and dreaming of this life in California. And I had to decide between LA and Newport Beach. And I figured I was coming out for a couple of years. And that was 30-some years ago now, so we're still here.
Incredible. And when did you make the switch to have your life be more mission-driven?
Yeah, I was working for a very, very wealthy individual in a private company in Newport Beach when this big downturn happened 10 years ago, literally, 2009, 10 years ago today, the economy and Southern California housing, everything was just crashing. And I just watched a lot of really good people lose their jobs, and I watched the face of hunger change right then, and I realized what was happening, and I felt moved. It took me a while to get to where I am or where I was going, but in 2011, I was, you know, cast into the lines of the unemployed when I, too, lost my job, and I knew then I'm a man of faith, and I knew God was doing for me what I couldn't do for my job, and it still took me a while to figure it out, and, you know, we had ideas about how we could feed people, and I tried really, really hard to keep my one foot firmly planted in the for-profit world. We develop a restaurant concept, and we're going to open this restaurant called Lettuce Seed. It was going to be a salad and sandwich shop on steroids, and we were going to morph into Lettuce Feed certain nights of the week. But we realized for many reasons that wouldn't work. And here in Southern California, in transportation, with transportation being what it is, how does someone get across town or across county to get a free meal? If you open a restaurant or soup kitchen, you're very small. It's ironic that, you know, we're talking about Broken Bread and Roy Choi, the godfather of, you know, the food truck movement, because I was sitting at a Starbucks one day and light bulbs started going off after a food truck drove by. And I'm like, that's it. We'll bring the food to the people. And that's kind of how it all started.
So you have a trio of programs at Bracken's Kitchen. Tell us what they are.
Well, it's ironic. Our trio has kind of almost become a duo, but a couple of years ago, 4 years ago now, when we really came up with this trio of services, is our food truck feeding program, which is how we went out in the communities and directly reached people. And then we had our recovered food program working with LA Specialty and the Chef's End Hunger program. And then, you know, we had this culinary training program that we've been toying with and are finally ready to get something off the ground in a more profound way. But recovered food is just, and food waste has become such a hot topic in America over the last couple of years. When the USDA reported up to 40% of our food supplies ending up in the trash can, it was in that we really had to dive in. And at the time, I kept the food truck feeding program completely separate from the recovered food program. But now, you wouldn't believe the things that are in our freezer, lobster, shrimp, chicken, veal, pork, all these things that came to us through our recovered food program. So that, you know, all of our food now that comes out of Bracken's Kitchen is recovered food, except for the small amount of items that we need to purchase just to supplement, you know, whether it's flour and butter and sugar, olive oil. But they've kind of, again, melded into that duo of services almost.
So when you're talking about recovered food, you're talking about something different than ugly produce or gleaning from farms. What is recovered food for your purposes?
It is all those things. I mean, recovered food is just as vast as, you know, the humans that walk around the streets of Santa Monica. I started out with the Chef's End Hunger program with LA Specialty, and we were getting leftover, over-prepared foods from hotels and restaurants, and that was the extent of recovered food to me. We get produce from farms, gleaned product. We must have got 350 cases of strawberries back in when it was raining fresh out of the fields in Orange County. One of the last farmers in Orange County who supplies to all the grocery stores, Ralph's, everybody, but they had some rain damage. They didn't look like they had rain damage to me. And I use the example of grocery rescue. You go into Ralph's grocery store, and they have a chicken breast or piece of meat that's fresh. And it usually says use or freeze by. Well, once it goes into the freezer, they can't sell it. So that becomes grocery rescue. And sometimes it's the leftovers into the night of a Chipotle. So we take it all in, anything we can, and we turn around and turn it into something healthy and tasty and nutritious.
Okay, so now let's talk about the end user, the eater. Take me through all the different audiences you have and how you serve them.
We go out with our food truck in the communities on a regular basis. So we're always touching the communities, and we know who the people are that are in the communities. You know, that's kind of the trademark of who we are, is the food truck feeding program. And then after that, our meals are going out to these 24 agencies. It could be a homeless shelter that has people living there that they have to feed them every day. It could be another nonprofit that hands out meals or food in their own food pantry. It could be motel families.
Let's talk about motel families. How do they end up there, and how many are out there?
That's a big question. How they end up there, I think it's the challenge of, especially in Southern California. You know, there's that old saying that so many people are one paycheck away from homelessness, and you lose a job, you get sick, something happens, and suddenly you're evicted, and you end up out in the street. And motels are, you know, if you do have any savings whatsoever, and you can drop $35 for a room at a motel, that's better than having your family on the street. And a lot of people live that way because they don't, I mean, to get into a motel, a one-bedroom motel that has really become a apartment of its own with a hot plate and a little refrigerator, there's all you have in a bathroom. You don't have to put a deposit, down payment. You don't have to come up with first and last month's rent. So when you're really struggling, the motels are the last stop, you know, sometimes before you end up on the street, and then you're knocking on the doors of organizations like the Illumination Foundation or someone to help.
I can't imagine how much a really good hot meal must change your world when you're in that kind of situation.
Well, we believe strongly in the power of food. And I, you know, my years in Beverly Hills and cooking at 12 years at the Peninsula, I came to this realization then that there's nothing in this world that evokes more passion and emotion in a person than food. Not art, literature, music, nothing. And not to drop any celebrity name to make them look bad, but when you have a major A-list celebrity in front of you screaming and yelling and upset because his oatmeal wasn't made the right way, It's like, dude, it's just oatmeal. But, you know, I come full circle to where I'm at today, and we realize that we all share the two most basic human needs for survival, the need to breathe and the need to eat. And the problem is air is free and food is not. And that gives food so much power over a person's life, whether you're the celebrity who's paying for it and you have an opinion about it, or whether you're a homeless person.
What are ways that listeners can get involved and help?
There's myriad ways. Go to our website, whether it's volunteering, whether it's donating, whether it's helping organize food drives, whether it's just raising awareness about food waste. And, you know, we're in Orange County, but we're sending food to L.A. You know, just a simple fact, when you think about the need in Southern California, 48% of all kids in Orange County are on the government-subsidized free and reduced lunch plan. That's one out of two kids in Orange County, one of the, you know, Newport Beach, Disneyland. One out of two kids doesn't have lunch today, right now, give or take, without the government's help. In L.A. County, that number jumps to 59%. So when you think about the need that's out there, what happens with these kids and their families on weekends and nights when they're not in school? So the need is great. So, you know, again, whether it's, you know, we talk about time, talent, and treasure. Somebody wants to volunteer. And if not Bracken's Kitchen, another nonprofit, you know, Martin Luther King said, actually Gandhi who said it, I'm sorry, there's the surest way to find yourself is to lose yourself in the service of others. And when you just get out and do something to help somebody else, it's such a personal good, feel good, spiritual, uplifting thing. So get involved somewhere.
Thank you so much, Bill.
You're very welcome. It's a pleasure to be here.
That's chef and founder of Bracken's Kitchen, Bill Bracken. We've been discussing his work to end hunger in Southern California. The episode of Broken Bread featuring Bill airs June 12th on KCET. Coming up, we're looking at catering of a very different sort. Think lavish dinners and expensive fundraisers. The hidden world of high-end catering when we return. Welcome back to Good Food on KCRW. I'm Evan Kleiman. My culinary career began in 1971 with catering. It was a bizarre alternative world of barely contained high energy combined with extraordinarily talented people and, of course, wackos. Catering chefs are the equivalent to the Wizard of Oz in the food world. Their world exists behind the curtain, from lavish dinners to fundraisers attended by thousands. For the catering chef, there is little time to reflect on a job well done. There are always more waiting to be served.
You know, if something goes wrong in a restaurant, you can send out a bottle of wine or comp their meal or something, and hopefully the situation's isolated. In catering, if that stack of desserts goes down into the grass, dessert's canceled.
I've been talking to authors Matt Lee and Ted Lee, who have written an insider's look at the world of high-end catering. Their book is called Hot Box. Hello, guys.
Hi there.
Hello, Evan.
What sparked your need to put yourself through what you went through to research this book?
So this is Matt talking. I'm the older brother, so I tend to dominate the conversation. But we both were just intrigued. We met some catering chefs in New York City and watched them, observed them as they handled a dicey situation at the James Beard House, as it happens, and recognize that this was something wholly different from restaurant world and the home cooking world that is our place. We've never worked in restaurants. We write Southern cookbooks for the most part. We've written three of them, but we knew that we didn't want to write a fourth one. What we wanted to do for the next 3 years, which turned into six, was to explore this subculture hiding in plain sight.
Yeah, this subculture, that's a $12 billion a year industry.
Right.
Before you...
Not quite subculture.
Before you stepped behind the pipe and drape, as we call it, what were your impressions of the business?
Before we went in, I think one of the reasons why we never really considered the life of a catering chef is that we simply thought, I think like many people, like, if you scale up food for hundreds or thousands, how can the food not be rote or designed to please everyone or just boring? Like, you know, the old stereotype of rubber chicken, like catering is rubber chicken dinners and it's, you know, just mass produced food. And by observing, we had the good fortune to observe a catering team in action, and we saw, you know, not only real interest in putting out restaurant quality food, but a resourcefulness we hadn't seen before. You know, these chefs at this very difficult dinner ran out of grill space. And so they made grills by inverting sheet pans on top of burners. And so it was like, wow, this is a real different kind of chef. And then we said, oh my gosh, you did such an amazing job at that dinner. And they said, you got to understand, that was 80 covers. Like, we don't start sweating until 800. And that's when we were sort of like, wow, we need to spend some time with you guys.
Yeah, I think the MacGyver nature of catering was always one of my favorite things.
Yeah.
Talking about MacGyver, let's talk about the title of your book, Hot Box. What is a hot box?
So a hot box is, in most of the country, called a transport cabinet. It's just something that carries sheet pans from one side of the kitchen to the other. But it turns out that right around the time you started catering, early 70s, a French chef at the Plaza Hotel banquet hall hacked this transport cabinet to allow him to use it as an oven. And it's aluminum. It has a door with a hinge, and that is the only control. It's, you know, crazy analog way to cook. And the way they do it is they put a sheet pan or two or three in there with a cluster of sternos, just those cans of alcohol jelly fuel lit to create a gentle heat in different zones of this very vertical 5.5-foot cabinet on casters. And it turns out to be the, kind of the secret to how restaurant quality food, at least in Manhattan, is accomplished in food inappropriate spaces like cement loading dock or out in a grassy field. And the reason for that is that in New York, unlike a lot of places in the country, propane is forbidden. There's 19th century freight elevators and 19th century wiring that couldn't sustain an electric oven. And so this sterno-fueled hot box is scalable, flexible, as long as you have those thousands of hours that it takes to know how to run it. It's kind of like a hot air balloon, and you just do it by touch, and you've got basically one control, which is the number of sternos you put into it and how far you crack the door open. It just amazed us that this analog system is powering some of the most important revenue-generating galas for the nation's cultural institutions here in New York.
So many of the parties that you detail are in scale and in aspiration, a level that goes beyond gilded. The number of subcontractors involved, the people that are going to show up, the pressure on the person at whatever institution is putting it on, who has right. the responsibility for the event.
We have to remember that catering at this level, special event catering, is most often a luxury product. I mean, it is a product for the 1%. It's a charity gala. It's a wedding. It's extravagant. And remember how it's ephemeral. It's simply the most expensive meal you're going to have because there are so many other costs externalized, like design, decor, flowers. Food is just a small piece of it. At the same time, the thing I don't think people realize is that in New York, I mean, many places across the country, I'm sure this is the case, but in New York, a lot of the most glittering event venues, the Met, MoMA, there's no kitchen on site for you to use. You're actually loading in the kitchen into an empty room or a loading dock, and then you're using it to cook from, and then you have to load it out at the end of the night and make sure it's swept clean. It's almost like a MASH unit, like a mobile army surgical hospital, because you're transporting the infrastructure and doing the thing and then getting out and moving on to the next.
So let's talk for a minute about how the expectation of the diner and the host has changed so much over the years. And I think one point where this really reveals itself is allergies, intolerances, and preferences and how they're dealt with.
You know, that was one thing that caterers told us when we were asking them what had changed over the years. They said allergies is now so much a part of their lives, just catering to everyone. They're really catering to everyone who has an allergy or who's disguising preferences as allergies, which sometimes happens. Caterers have always been prepared to deal with allergies, and for religious reasons, you know, some people don't eat things. So that's been a part of the culture, I think, for as long as we've had modern catering. But caterers have been able to execute and accommodate people's allergies so much that actually guests arrive at the venue having not communicated with the caterer what their allergies are and just expecting that they'll be accommodated. Whereas every caterer wants to make sure that everyone is going to have a meal that they can tolerate from a health perspective, but they really need advance warning. And so that's what we're hoping our book sort of spreads the message for people who do go to parties, that it's totally fine to have to arrive with an allergy, but you need to let the caterer know in advance. Because one thing about the invisibility about things being behind the pipe and drape is that as catered food has gotten better, as they've been able to cater to different allergies, people assume that there's an actual restaurant behind there.
The problem with a caterer being exceptionally creative and accommodating is that as the more they bust through that rubber chicken expectation, the more the guests expect restaurant-level accommodations and think that they're miracle workers and just presume that everything's going to be as it is at the local restaurant. And so they create more problems by being more excellent.
Could you share a couple of the most outlandish customized requests you came across or heard of during your research?
I worked a party, a wedding in the Hudson Valley, where each course, it was, an hour-long cocktail hour and then a seven-course meal. And each course was a tribute to a meal the happy couple had had in their travels. I remember the amuse-bouche, that first impression of the meal after the cocktail hour was a spherified spiced corn soup in tomato water with a few, garnishes on top. What else?
Oh, the best one is another happy couple had a moment in Italy where the groom ordered an affogato. And
espresso poured over ice cream.
But the Italian waiter, perceiving that he was a Yank, assumed that he had said avocado and brought him an avocado. And so the happy couple demanded of the catering chef for their wedding that he produce an avocado affogato. Ha ha ha. And so the catering team had to R&D such a monstrosity and to make it taste good, because if it didn't taste good, it was going to be a disappointment no matter what story it's
so told. Avocado ice cream with a shot of espresso poured over it.
Nom nom nom.
And actually, ice cream happens to be one of the harder things to do in catering, because as you know it has to temper, and it only has 5 minutes to temper. And
yeah, you either get soup or you get hardness.
Exactly, right.
And there's so many, for all of the planning, 9 months of planning, every detail, every minute of the run of show, every piece of material that comes to the party, things happen.
So despite all of this that it takes to put on a wonderful event, describe what it feels like when it all goes right and you're just part of this ultimate flow.
There's really nothing like it, and certainly nothing that Matt and I have experienced. We have a very small operation. We're freelancers. We develop our own recipes for cookbooks, but really working with a team in the way that a catering team needs to really work in sync and together, there's just no room for anyone not to be sort of in the crewing skull, rowing in the same direction. And it goes with other vendors to the party. Like, there was a party that Matt and I worked out at a beach where there was live music, and we needed space on the AV man's stage sort of to do our...
To fry grouper.
And so the AV guy gave us some space on his platform, and then we gave him some grouper. And it was just like this whole world is connecting, and it's all about hospitality, and we're having a good time. We're under the stars on a beach in East Hampton, Long Island, and it's just a great feeling.
And yet the bittersweet part of it is on the van ride home, everyone's just flat out exhausted. I mean, it's hard work, and then you have to do it again the next day.
Well, I have to tell you, too, that it was just a marvelous read. I enjoyed it so much.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Evan.
I've been talking to authors Matt Lee and Ted Lee, who have written an insider's look at the world of high-end catering. Their book is called Hot Box. After the break, we're learning about a new taco fest in town, plus a new review from Bill Addison. Stick around. Welcome back to Good Food on KCRW. I'm Evan Kleiman.
Taquear is a verb, so it's very common in Mexico for when you're going out with your friends, your family, say, vamos a taquear. So that means we're going to go get tacos. And so tacos are a verb. It's an action. It's a way of life.
That's Bill Esparza, whom you probably know as our favorite taco expert. On June 15th, Bill's bringing a new taco festival to the Row DTLA, featuring a slate of nearly 50 taqueros, personally curated by the man himself. It's called Taqueando. Hi, Bill.
Hello, Evan.
Tell us just the details before we really get into it. When is it? Where is it?
Taqueando is June 15th at the Row in downtown L.A. It's going to be at the lot right at the entrance, where right in front of the old American Apparel building.
And one of the things I love is all the PR is calling it an example of the taco lifestyle.
That is correct. Well, you know, tacos, it's funny because there's always been this thing about tacos, you know, people saying, well, there's more to Mexican food than tacos. And when people say that, I always think that, well, you know, I think you're missing the point about the tortilla is the original silverware, you know. We didn't have forks and spoons and knives. We ate with tortillas and tamales. And so it's always been a lifestyle. So even when you're not eating tacos, you're making tacos, you know. That's just the way we eat. That's part of our culture. And I remember one time I heard Enrique Olvera in an interview say that too. It's like it's not a meal. It's a way of life. It's more than just, you know, nourishing yourselves. It's a lifestyle. It's what you do after after the movies in Mexico, after a party. People go out and get tacos. They get tacos for lunch. They grab tacos in the morning. I mean, there's any part of Mexico, any time of the day, there's some taco available. And when we're not eating tacos, we're making tacos.
There are many of us who feel that tacos are the perfect food and the perfect eating experience.
Yeah, the original grab and go.
Yeah, the original grab and go. You have an incredible lineup this year. How many vendors, more or less, will there be? And how many different municipalities or regions or countries or states are represented?
Well, we're going to have 50 vendors, about 50. And I have two states in Mexico. I have Nuevo León and Baja California, which we always, you know, always been working with. And we have San Diego, and I have Sacramento, London, and Arizona. And of course, the core is the best of Los Angeles and all the, you know, the different Mexican cuisines of Los Angeles, traditional Mexican street food, Mexican-American, and modern Mexican-American chefs. So quite the diversity. And, you know, Los Angeles at any given time has about half of the Mexican states represented, but certain ones are a little bit more prominent. So we're certainly going to be representing Sinaloa, Oaxaca, Mexico City style, and Jalisco, and Nayarit, which are the big five Mexican cuisines in Los Angeles that you're going to find around town. And, you know, many other states too. And then we have, I mean, I'm really excited. We have a surprise guest coming from Tijuana that's never been in an event in the United States. They're called Tacos Arron, and they do tacos varios, which is, that's how they say taco de guisado in Baja California. And they are one of my favorite trucks. I've been going for a decade, and I'm really happy they're coming.
So aside from Tacos Arron, I always feel like every time you do one of these festivals, there ends up being one or two who are already stars when they come, or they get pushed to greater stardom through the event and through the social insanity that goes on. So many photographs of so many tacos. Who do you think are those that we should really look at this time around?
Well, you know, just really who's been exploding everywhere is Poncho's Tlayudas.
So good.
You know, this, and they're going to be doing tacos, and they're really starting to make the entire event scene, which is great. You know, doing these festivals has always been about connecting all these different vendors, because a lot of them don't get a chance to even go to each other's places, you know. There's another one from San Diego that I really love called, well, there's actually two coming in from San Diego that are new. There's Tuétano Taqueria that, I mean, come on, it's a bone marrow taco concept. And they're coming up here. They just opened this last year, and another guy that does tacos, varios, sort of like San Diego Baja style. He's called Dos Tierras. That's his the name of his stand. I'm really excited about that one. I think that's going to be something people haven't seen.
Along with some of our favorites like Mariscos Jalisco, La Guerrerense from Ensenada.
The classics.
Yeah, the classics. Well, thank you so much for putting this together again. I know it's not easy, like herding cats, but you were...
Well, you know, because you and I started this together.
So long ago. And had to...
You remember how hard it was to just get four vendors?
Oh my gosh. They thought that we were selling them some sort of fraudulent thing. We were begging people to come.
Yeah. It was really hard. And, you know, and really that was, I want to say that was back in, God, what year that was. But back then we didn't have as many taquerias as we do now. There is an explosion of taquerias in Los Angeles. Even this last year, we've seen so many new players. But back then we didn't have a lot. But if you remember, Mariscos Jalisco and Connie Seafood did that event. And they're still around, and they've become big stars.
Yeah, I mean, I would imagine, how many people do you imagine coming? Are we talking about hundreds or thousands?
Previously I was curating the Tacolandia event, which really got to be, I think, quite big in terms of vendors and people. So this event only, we're only going to sell 2,500 tickets. So. You know, and then you count all the people that are working inside and all that. So it's going to be a smaller event, only 50 vendors, a lot more intimate. And I think as far as for this number, for 50 people, 50 vendors, it's the best event I've ever curated. So I'm really excited. I'm excited to go eat the tacos.
Yeah, the lineup is extraordinary.
Yeah, and we're all going to be taqueando.
And we should mention that the event is for folks 21 and over, and you can go on to the KCRW website to get the link to be able to find your way to ticket sales. Thank you so much, Bill.
Thanks, Evan. Always a pleasure to talk tacos with you.
Even more of a pleasure to eat them. I'll see you there.
Okay.
I've been talking to Bill Esparza about Taqueando, a brand new taco festival coming to the Row DTLA on June 15th. For a full list of the vendors and tickets, visit taqueandofest.com. Finally, we close out with a new restaurant recommendation from LA Times critic Bill Addison. Let's see what he has for us. Hi, Bill.
Hi, Evan.
Where are we headed today?
We are headed to one of my favorite neighborhood restaurants in Los Angeles right now. It's Joy in Highland Park.
I have to say, I haven't heard of anybody talking about Joy without actual joy.
I love this place. It just feels so good. So this is the second restaurant from Vivian Q, who also owns Pine and Crane in Silver Lake. And it's a similar variation. She is riffing off the foods of her Taiwanese-American heritage. At Joy, she dips into a few other dishes that she doesn't do at Pine and Crane, but... First, the place just feels, it's just flooded with sunshine, and the staff is really cheerful, and the space just feels good. One of those places where you drop in, I love it for lunch. Like, you're not staying forever, you're not sitting in for like a meal that lasts hours, but you just kind of settle in and feel present, and the service is quick and friendly, and I just love it there.
What are we eating?
We are starting with some really beautiful small salads that are displayed in the front case. My favorite are the soy braised peanuts. I actually take those home in big containers and eat them for breakfast. You asked me what I eat for breakfast. I don't eat much, but I do eat those. There are bamboo shoots and seaweed salads and crispy pig ear salads. It's just a beautiful way to kind of start your meal there.
And then where do we go? Do we go dumpling?
I like wontons. I think we go wontons. I am particularly fond of just the simple pork and shrimp wonton in broth. I feel like the wrapping really gets that particular slipperiness that you want. And the broth has a really clear, you know, chickeny taste to it that is just kind of like exactly what that dish should be. There's also a really wonderful version of Lu Ru Fan, which is spiced ground pork over rice. The star anise kind of zings through the mixture. And there's a tea egg on the side, and there's pickled daikon. And it just all comes together in those, like, earthy, spicy, acidic bites that just make that dish so classic and satisfying.
So I'm not going to be eating that dish because of my aversion to star anise. Oh. So give me something else to chew on.
Okay. I'm going to send you in the sandwich direction. There is a variation of, like, really plush sesame scallion bread that comes out of northern China traditions.
Yum.
Yeah, and they stuff it with soy braised tofu that's really delicious, or pork belly that's very low on the star anise. This would make you happy. Oh, and you want a pile of greens on the side, just garlicky snow pea shoots are what often they're serving these days. And then something sweet at the end, like mochi, but it is not so much Japanese mochi. It's a Hakka variation on mochi. And so it's rolled in crushed peanut and black sesame.
I wish it was next door.
I wish it was too. We would go eat there together right now.
That sounds so delicious. Well, thank you so much, Bill.
Thank you, Evan.
I've been talking with LA Times restaurant critic Bill Addison about Joy in Highland Park. Visit the Good Food website for a link to Bill's LA Times review. That's kcrw.com/goodfood. That's it for our show this week. If you missed any of it, listen on our website or on KCRW's mobile app. Subscribe on Apple Podcasts or Stitcher. And as always, leave us a review if you liked what you heard. My thanks to the Good Food team. They are Nick Liao, Laurel Garcia, Joel Stein, Joseph Stone, and Ronnie Mickelson. Special thanks to Amy Ta, Kenny Ng, Paola Mardo, and Laura Kondarajan. I'm Evan Kleiman, and I'll be back next week with a brand new episode of Good Food.